That is the fundamental aim of the brain, is continually redefining normality. It's constantly adapting. But what's powerful is that you can have agency in the direction of your adaptability. Understanding perception and becoming aware of how and why I perceive what I do, in general and in particular, suddenly gives you the possibility of choice.
It's easy to talk about the successes, but what doesn't get talked about enough is the struggle. My name is Eric Weinmayer. I've gotten the chance to ascend Mount Everest, to climb the tallest mountain in every continent, to kayak the Grand Canyon, and I happen to be blind. It's been a struggle to live what I call a no-barriers life, to define it, to push the parameters of what it means. And part of the equation is diving into the learning process and trying to illuminate the universal elements that exist along the way. And that unexplored terrain between those dark places we find ourselves in the summit exists a map. That map, that way forward, is what we call no barriers.
Today's conversation is with Dr. Bo Lotto, a neuroscientist and world-renowned expert in perception. His research explores the ways in which we experience the world through our own versions of reality. As Bo puts it, the brain never sees the world as it actually is, only the world that is useful to see. Bo is a three-time main stage TED speaker and is the founder of the world's first neurodesign studio called Lab of Misfits. Part lab, part creative studio, Lab of Misfits takes a disruptive approach to research, partnering with brands to blend science, art, and performance to explore pivotal principles in current culture. Enjoy the conversation. Welcome to our new weekly No Barriers podcast series, where we continue to explore this extraordinary moment in our lives while remaining true to the theme that we've always emphasized here. What's within you is stronger than what's in your way. Special thanks to Prudential and Wells Fargo for their support of this podcast series. Well, Eric, welcome back. Another great conversation today. You've brought your friend and colleague Bo Lotto with you. Tell us a little bit about why you were excited to bring Bo onto the show.
Dr. Bo Lotto, hey, good morning here in Colorado, but evening there in UK, I know. So welcome to our No Barriers podcast. And I'm so lucky that I got to meet you and pulled you into our podcast, because I know people will benefit from your story and all the things that you've researched and can illuminate for us right now.
Well, it's great to be here. And whether or not I can illuminate, I hope to be illuminated at the same time.
Yeah, sure. We'll illuminate you back. Hey, so I wanted to like kick in right into something kind of big and heavy, which is, you know, in COVID right now, like we're just coming out of this quarantine and, you know, it just kind of puts this layer of dread over the world. So I'm just wondering, you know, is our perception of what's going on reality? Is there an objectiveness, or is a lot of the stuff that we see and perceive inside ourselves?
You're right. That is a big question. In some senses, it's kind of the biggest. Yeah. So how long do we have? First of all, there is a physical world. There is a physical reality out there. Okay. The question is whether or not we evolve to see it. And our work, and not just our work, the work of many neuroscientists, suggests that we didn't actually evolve to see the world as it really is, though it does exist. This is not postmodern relativism, okay? But in fact, it wouldn't be useful to see the world as it really is. We see something else. We see something that was useful to see in the past. When you open your eyes or reach out and touch or listen with your ears, right, or open your mouth to taste, you're experiencing through millions of years of evolution. Okay. Your window onto the world has been shaped by the history of experience, and not just your experience, the experience of your family, of your community, of your culture, and of your evolutionary history. All of that is encoded in the functional structure of your brain. So when you get a stimulus, it could be any kind of stimulus that your brain is sensing, you then generate a reflexive perception based on what that stimulus would have meant for your behavior in the past. Okay. So the underlying principle that is guiding all those perceptions and behaviors are the biases and assumptions that you use to experience the world, to make sense of the world. And while many people think, oh, that sounds a bit scary in a way, because if I'm not seeing the real world, what am I seeing? Or if I'm not hearing the real world, if I'm not touching the real world, what is it that I'm experiencing? And actually, it's actually freeing, because it means that you have the possibility to experience something different from what you're experiencing now. You could have agency in what you're going to perceive in the future, right? So that's how we see, in a sense.
Bo, can you, just because this is such an important point, I know Eric's asked this big question and you're kind of laying the groundwork for the foundation of the idea first. I love your talks. And can you just give our listeners an example of the gap between how our brains are wired for this historical view of the world and the reality? Just like a kind of make it really concrete. You have so many good examples from your talks.
The reason why there are a number of examples that we can think about how what we perceive is different from what's actually there. Okay. And also how it is we've come to experience the world in the way we have. So our ancestors, if they came upon a dark space coming from the ground, they had no way of knowing whether that could be a shadow or a hole. Okay. And let's say it happened to be a hole. The ones that actually walked around, they survived. The ones that stepped into it fell and they were selected out. The ones that walked around, their genes are now with us. The ones that didn't are not. Okay. So the reason why it has to be this way is because all the information your brain is receiving from the world is inherently uncertain. It's ambiguous. And it's because it could literally mean anything. So something that's small and far away, something small and up close could generate the same image on your eye as something large and far away. Or something that's loud and far away could generate the same intensity as something that's quiet and up close. And your brain has no access to that physical world other than through its senses. So one of the things we're experiencing right now is this tremendous sense of uncertainty, okay? But uncertainty is something that it happens every second of every day. We've evolved to deal with uncertainty. So that's why your brain then takes that ambiguous information and generates a meaning from it according to that history. So when you're perceiving a shadow, you're actually perceiving the meaning of the light. When you're hearing a sound, you're actually perceiving the meaning of the sound, not the sound.
So your brain has to learn the pattern of that shadow means possible death, and you start to avoid it. But when you're in a situation like right now, this is the first time a lot of us in our lifetimes are experiencing this kind of uncertainty. Isn't the brain like at a total loss?
Our evolved brain has experienced this before. Our evolved brain has experienced threat before. We've experienced the possibility of imminent death before. And when that happens, we panic. It's a very natural response, because what your brain is saying, it's a bit like nausea. Your brain, when you ingest something that is not good for your body, your brain says, well, that was a bad idea. I want to get rid of that. I better give this feeling of nausea, so I throw it up, right? Similarly, when you're experiencing panic, your brain is saying, well, last time I experienced this, a tiger was chasing me or whatever. This is a bad place to be. I better get somewhere away from here. I don't care where I go. I just want to not be here. So much happens in that moment where your heart rate increases, your respiratory rate increases, the blood gets shunted to your muscles, in a sense, away from your brain. You stop thinking. Your, what I call your space of possibility, your creativity completely diminishes, and you just run. You just flee, right? You panic, okay? And what also happens is that from that moment of panic, it's almost, it's a natural response. It's a very good idea, but not in the long run, right? We have to overcome that panic. And there are ways of actually overcoming that panic. But panic is a very natural response. Panic is your brain's desire to try to find certainty in the moment of uncertainty.
So we have those patterns that we're building up, and therefore we think, you know, we react because we think that metaphorical tiger is after us. Or maybe we're making an assumption, right? And that seems really hard. You know, the hormones are firing and you're just running. So how do you start to change your assumptions or your patterns? It seems like, you know, maybe those are just locked in.
Yeah. And they're not locked in the sense that we can't, it's not that we can't escape them. Okay. We're not trapped. And that's why, that's the beauty of the brain, which is that's evolved to evolve, it's adapted to adapt. One of the things that the brain does is it's continually redefining normality. People talk about this new normal. And in my talks, I talk about how that is a fundamental aim of the brain, is continually redefining normality. It's constantly adapting. But what's powerful is that you can have agency in the direction of your adaptability. Right. And so when you ask what's one of the key steps we can do to deal with the panic we might be feeling, it's awareness. It's awareness of that you're doing it and understanding why you're doing it. Understanding is remarkably powerful, because choice only really happens when you know you have it. When you're conscious, you become aware, conscious of not just what you're doing, but why you're doing it. So often we are reflexively generating behaviors that are grounded in our assumptions and biases, and much of which we inherited. They weren't even constructed by us. And then our brain tells us a post hoc narrative, say, well, the reason why I did that was this, right? And so we have this illusion of sort of that conscious intention, but that's often just an illusion. It's only in being aware that you're actually reflexively responding that you have the possibility of changing that reflex. So the first step is just to become aware that that's what's happening. And so that's why understanding perception and becoming aware of how and why I perceive what I do in general and in particular suddenly gives you the possibility of choice.
I mean, I completely understand what you're saying, and we teach some of these very same principles at No Barriers. I think it's like super hard for individuals. You know, let's say you lost your job, as millions and millions of Americans have recently lost their jobs, or you had a loved one that you lost. How do you have that ability in the midst of, you know, pretty big challenges in your life to pause and reflect on your response when you're all caught up in the moment?
Yeah. I mean, it's a tremendous question, and it's actually an exercise. It's a practice. This is not something that you suddenly just switch on. It's like lifting weights. Your brain is like a muscle. Right? It's not literally a muscle, but it's like a muscle. You use it or you lose it. Okay. And so this is a practice. It's in that moment that that's actually, you could argue, the moment when you have actual freedom, actual choice. Because what your brain is going to do, it's going to look at the obvious. It's going to focus and attend on what's it's always done before, on those past reflexive meanings. That's what it's going to do. And there's nothing wrong with that in the sense that it's very natural. But it's in that moment you have the possibility of attending away from the obvious. So if you're driving down the road, if your listeners are driving down the road, and you experience, we've all experienced, so we're driving down the road, we're in a traffic jam, and yet the accident's in the opposite direction. Why on earth am I in a traffic jam? And it's because everybody is looking, right? They're looking at the obvious, because we attend to shiny objects, we attend to high contrast, right? Now try not attending to it. Try attending away from it. A loud noise, someone whispers your voice in the far corner, you attend to it. It's hard not to. So yes, when that moment and you're completely overwhelmed, it's in that moment that you have the possibility, not of doing something else, but of just stopping. Of pausing, right? The first step to go from A to B is not B. The first step is to go from A to not A, right? And it's not to not feel the feeling. It's to trying to not attach the meaning to the feeling that you attached before, right? It's a crazy idea to say if something terrible or sad has happened, oh, don't feel the terrible, sad thing. That would be delusional. Feel it, but try not to attach the meaning to it that I'm a bad person, I cause this, etc. Let yourself feel the feeling. And then through behavior, you try to change the meaning of that feeling. That fear can be a reason not only to stay in bed, it can also be a reason to get out of bed.
Hmm. Wow. All this stuff you're talking about is, I mean, it's really a lot about psychology too, right? And it could, because in terms of, you know, like you talk about these assumptions that you make, for instance, about people, like we're all spending a lot of time with our loved ones right now. And of course you can have a lot of love and fun and joy, but they can also get on your nerves, right? And so my wife and I spending a lot of time together, you know, we'll break into like these arguments and I scratch my head and I say, what the heck? How did that even, that was the most meaningless argument. And it's because, right, we're attaching certain meanings to the other person based on our history or based on, you know, past things going on inside of us, right?
Yes, absolutely. When we are feeling those emotions and our blood pressure rising, etc., in some sense, it says more about, it says less about the world in front of you. It says more about what's in the world inside you.
Right.
Okay. So when we experience distress, when we are experiencing something negative, often it's because what you're experiencing does not match your expectations. When you're experiencing something positive, it's because what you're experiencing matches your expectations. What's interesting is that that can be both good and bad, in the sense I might have the expectation of something negative. And when I experience the negative thing that I expect to happen, in some sense, I feel good about it. I have a sense of, oh, that's exactly what I thought was going to happen. You know, you can imagine even your personal arguments with your wife or someone, and when they say something and you knew that's what they're going to say, how often people say, I knew you were going to say that, even though what they just said was negative, right? And then the nature of the emotion can tell you which of your assumptions and biases is actually being challenged, okay? So your emotions and feelings tell you a lot about, if anything, they tell you more about you than they tell you about the world. And so when dealing with, and we're going to do a whole series on sort of relationships, romantic relationships and otherwise, and so much of this thinking about perception and what we're experiencing now is we're in conflict. We're in conflict with the world, but we also can be in conflict with each other. And to be in conflict is to be in a situation that's different from what I expect. I'm now in conflict. And so often we are told that we should be entering conflict with answers, entering conflict with certainty. So often when we're in conflict, as you might be with your wife, is you put each other on opposite ends of the same line, and your aim is to prove that she's wrong and to shift you towards her. And she's trying to do exactly the opposite, prove that you're wrong and to shift you towards her, right? And notice that you're both set up to try to win, but neither of you are trying to learn. And the only way you can learn is to enter that conflict with a question, with the aim of understanding, with the aim of convincing. And you can generalize that not only to the conflict with a partner, but the conflict with the world, or even the conflict of where we're facing right now, is to enter it with a question, not with a certainty, but with uncertainty, and try to understand and understand yourself in this remarkable context that we're now facing.
Is that sort of like step two? Step one is be aware of the feelings in your response and make that awareness present. Yep. And then as a next step, how might I reframe this as something to explore?
Yes. As Jung said, problems are never fixed. We only change our perspective on them. Right. So what you're trying to do is, and unfortunately, or too unfortunately, you have a lot of psychology and positive psychology that says, well, just ignore the negative, right? Let's just focus on the positive. And I think that's not necessarily a good strategy. And rather, I think it's to embrace the complexity of the situation. And through that, you get awareness and understanding. And then the next step is to try to be proactive, to have agency in where you're going to go. You can choose what to attend to. You can look away. You can attend away from the obvious. What you don't have control over is where you're going to go from there. But then what you can do is create an environment that creates the possibility of going to a new place.
Yeah. Yeah, we have we work with a lot of veterans. And, you know, when I lead groups in the mountains, inevitably you have a lot of folks with trauma, right? They've had trauma. And so like their behavior and their sort of perceptions are so ingrained. And you always see one of the vets in the beginning of the process, trying to what I call blow things up, right? They're like, oh gosh, you know, like this isn't going to work out for me. I already know it. So I might as well blow it up like right now so I don't get crushed and get my hopes and expectations, you know, too far here. Like I'm going to blow it up so I can just be familiar with my past patterns.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
That makes complete sense, because I personally think one of the fundamental challenge of the brain and of any living system is dealing with uncertainty. We hate uncertainty. Almost every behavior we do is an attempt to decrease it. There are only certain contexts in which we actually seek to increase uncertainty, which we can talk about. So to step into uncertainty is a very scary place, because during evolution, dying was easy. Staying alive, that's what was hard, right? And so, because there are more ways of dying than staying alive. So as soon as you become uncertain, you've literally statistically increased the probability of death. You know, if everything was fine, you had your roof over your head and you had your food and you had your family and a fire, what a stupid idea to go see what's on the other side of the hill, right? You would have just literally increased the probability of dying. So we engineer life for familiarity, because familiarity is safe. The irony is that, of course, if we only stay safe, we never adapt, we never evolve, we never change, we can never innovate. So we're kind of caught in this place where I want familiarity, because that's safe and it increases the chances of surviving, and I'll engineer my whole environment around it. Companies do this, right? Businesses do this. They're creative once, and then they try to maximize efficiency. And then that's a great idea if the world never changed. But as we are experiencing now, and in a very extreme way, the world does change. And so you have to change with it. So you actually have to go see what's on the other side of that hill. But there's a way of engaging with that. So when, in the case of the person with whom you're experiencing, had the tremendously awful experience of that trauma, when you get attached to those familiar responses, they become part of your identity. Your assumptions and biases and those reflexes define who you are, right? And one of the greatest sources of uncertainty, in the sense of strongest, is to doubt who you are, your own identity. Because if you can't even predict yourself what you're going to do next, which is defined by your identity, then what do you have? So better, in psychologically in some sense, is to ignore, you know, to either defend, get hateful and angry, or become delusional and pretend it didn't even exist in the first place, or, you know, blame others. And that way you can hold on to that identity, even if that identity is destructive. And you see that so frequently. And it's not just out there, it's in all of us. We all do this in different ways. Some just maybe more apparent.
I really like how you said I hate change. I mean, our humans hate change. I like that, because, you know, you hear all in this pop psychology, you're supposed to love change. You're supposed to love uncertainty. People always with me, they're like, you know, when I'm starting these processes, like going out and kayaking or learning to climb or something, new project, they're like, oh, you just forge into the great unknown and you're so positive. No way. I'm freaking terrified.
Absolutely.
I hated it at the time. I look back and I think, okay, I'm proud of the way I kept going and was resilient. But at the time, I am not having a great time.
No, absolutely. I completely agree with you. And people do this, you know, motivational stuff. And the motivational stuff is about almost like go forward with confidence and all that. And when we've worked with kids, and Dave Strudwick, a very good colleague, and we've developed an education program that facilitates children stepping into uncertainty. We use science as a Trojan horse for that, which we come back to the environment and where uncertainty is a good thing as an example. But the point is that with these children, some of them from very difficult upbringings and environments, right? I'm not interested in confidence. If you're doing something with confidence, then you already know what's going to happen, at least in your mind. So why do it? What's far more interesting is courage. Doing something with the thought that it might go wrong, and even with the probability that it will go wrong. In fact, most things do, because there's more ways that things will go wrong than they will go right. Right? So when my daughter, when she was a dancer, you know, she would be up on stage, and before going on stage, she'd say, "Dad, you know, I'm really scared." And I'd say, "That's because you're smart, right? What you're doing is scary. It might all go wrong. What's amazing is that you're doing it anyway." And it's in that moment that you both, and I say to my kids, it's in that moment that you both reveal yourself and you create yourself.
The anti-motivational speech that at the same time is actually incredibly motivational.
Yeah. And so I actually hate uncertainty, which is probably why I study it, right? I mean, all of our work is about how the brain deals with uncertainty. And not just the brain, but any living adaptive system is dealing with uncertainty. Flowers, grass, cows, they're all dealing with the same thing, right? Dealing with uncertainty, making meaning out of meaningless, right? For anything, if you weren't sure that was a predator, it's too late. Okay. So all living systems are doing this. And so we focus on adaptive systems in general. But I personally hate uncertainty. I think what the brain really loves is closure. I think we love the resolution of uncertainty. You know, you hear this in DJs. My son's in that room. So I have two sons. One's downstairs and he's recording his rap. The other one's got his spinning disc and he's doing mixes with DJs. He does live DJ sets and everything, right? It's brilliant. And they're teaching me how to DJ. Like so many things, it's so easy to do poorly and so hard to do well. So I now have a tremendous respect for that art form of DJing. But what we do and what they do in the DJs, of course, is they ramp up the music. You know, they ramp it up. Mozart did this. Bach did this, right? You ramp it up. You ramp it up. What you're doing is you're building up that anticipation. You're building up uncertainty. And then suddenly the beat drops. You drop the beat and you've experienced it in nightclubs. And then suddenly all the bodies move forward and they all move in the rhythm, right? Because we love closure. And so I think that's, for some of us, we love closure so much that in order to get that closure, you have to have the uncertainty that came before. It doesn't make sense. You can't have closure without uncertainty. It doesn't exist. You just can't, you know, that's literally what an orgasm is, right? That's what we love. We love those experiences, but you have to have the uncertainty first. Mm. And some of us just have that problem. It's a bit of a pathology.
You're giving us a little bit of the recipe for moving from, you know, uncertainty, building awareness of your emotions, starting to question and be open to possibilities. You started the episode by talking about what our brains are wired to do. What's happening in our neuroscience when we're starting to do these other things? Are we literally rewiring patterns? Tell us about what neuroscience is showing is happening when we're doing this process that you're going through.
Yeah. So your brain is a complex reflex arc. And you could argue no different from the reflex arc that goes from your patellar tendon just underneath your knee, up your leg to your spinal cord and back again. So when you go to the doctor and he or she hits your patellar tendon, your leg goes out. Okay. That's a reflex arc. You don't have to think about it. You don't need to be cognitive in order for that thing to happen. Same thing's happening inside our brain. Information falls onto your retina, into your eardrum, your nose, and it activates just a more complex set of network that was instantiated, you know, encoded based on your past responses to the world. Okay, so the more often you perform that reflex arc, the stronger is that connectivity. The more likely you're going to do it in the future if you get the same stimulus then as you do now. So you reaffirm the connections between those cells that instantiate that reflex arc. Okay, which means that in order to create, what you want to do is create a new circuit, new connectivity, which means you have to diminish the power of the first circuit in order to construct the new one. Now, you're literally growing tissue when that happens. You are literally changing this, what's called synaptic weights, the connectivity between cells. Your brain is an incredibly expensive structure. 20% of the energy that you consume goes to 2% of your body mass. Thinking is expensive, right? Which is why I like to say, which is why so few people do it, that we will follow a path of least resistance because it conserves energy. Operating by these reflexes is a great idea. You use less energy. But also a lot of these reflexes keep us alive, right? Walking is a reflexive response. Sitting, you don't think, oh, I wonder if the physics are going to work on that chair. I better look at the molecules, etc. You have the assumption that the chair is not going to give way. And then suddenly it does. And you think, well, that was a bit of a shocker, right? We don't wonder every day whether the sun's going to come up. In fact, we evolved. When we come into the world, we assume that light comes from above, etc. We have that built-in assumption. So much of our behavior is reflexive, and that's a very good thing. It's just that it was reflexive for a certain context. The problem is context change. So therefore, you have to change your reflexes. And you do that first by activating, where I say, activate your prefrontal. Your prefrontal cortex is the front of your brain. It's our newest neural innovation. It's our newest evolutionary structure. And what your prefrontal cortex does, there are a number of different structures in there, but let's just call it in general the prefrontal. What it does is when it's active, it inhibits other parts of the brain. So when you're meditating, you're actually activating your prefrontal. And what it's doing is it's inhibiting the circuits, these reflexes, which create the possibility of new reflexes, new circuits being born and constructed or remodeled, of redefining a new normality based on new experiences. So activating your prefrontal is about becoming proactive in the world. And that's a decision. But that decision doesn't happen if you don't first have awareness, and then even deeper, not just knowing, but understanding. What you really want is understanding, because that's information that's generalizable. Knowing is efficient. Understanding, wisdom, is adaptable.
You've talked about adaptability, but I mean, we've also talked a lot about it's way easier to die than live. And it's, you know, and we like familiarity, we like closure. So why is it so important that we adapt? I mean, like what's the result of being adaptable in our lives and in the world?
Oh, many things. First of all, you literally survive. Okay.
Yeah.
During evolution. And I don't like, you don't die off. I mean, we used to have a phrase, and I have it in my talks, adapt or die. I can't, of course, use that slide because that wouldn't be very sensitive at the moment. But it's during evolution, it was literally true, right? But I would rather say adapt or thrive, you know, thrive through adapting. So when your brain is more adaptable, you have the increased probability of thriving. But it's also the nature of the way of being that's adaptable, that also facilitates your wellness. So for instance, if you feel you're more adaptable, your fear of uncertainty will decrease because you feel like you will be able to be agile to something that you haven't experienced before. So your cortisol levels will go down, for instance. Now, when cortisol is a hormone that gets increased when we are stressed. A lot of people right now are experiencing high levels of cortisol, which is also affecting their dreams, by the way. People now are experiencing very strong dreams, and it's because your brains are now in a sort of a constant level of low-level panic. Okay, cortisol levels are elevated, respiratory rates are high, etc. Okay, so when that stays high for a long period of time, cortisol in particular, then what happens is your immune system actually starts deteriorating. You become more susceptible to illness. And if you get an illness, the response will be stronger. That's the last thing we want right now. Your brain cells can actually start withering and dying. Your creativity goes down. You become a more extreme version of yourself. If you're liberal, you become liberal. If you're conservative, you become conservative. Why? Because you're going to a place of familiarity. You're trying to get certainty. You also become more gullible, which is why we see one consequence of a disempowered brain is you start seeing patterns where no pattern exists. The illusions that I make on my website, they actually get stronger. That's why we're experiencing more conspiracy theories. Why? Because people are trying to find patterns because they're trying to find certainty. When you have a disempowered brain, you need certainty so much that you'll start grasping and you'll start finding relationships that don't actually exist. In fact, your eye movements, your sound, your attention of your ears will start trying to find information that confirms what you believe to be true already. All of that happens. You live less long. You're more likely to increase weight, right? So if you become adaptable, that way of being adaptable increases the possibility of thriving.
Yeah. And when you're sitting there in that uncertain situation where you are now required to be adaptable, of course, there's fear and there's doubt and anxiety. But there's also kind of awe, right? Sometimes like, wow, like what the heck is that? And I've heard you speak a lot about awe. So tell us the positive side there.
Yeah. Awe is a wonderful thing. It can also be weaponized. So like so many things, it's all about context. So but what is awe? And what does it do to your brain? And how might it be applied now? We can talk about. So first of all, we being humans have been thinking about, writing about, exploring awe for hundreds of years and engendering it in ourselves and experiencing it. And you'll be experiencing it in the sounds and the experiences that you had going down those rapids. And what happens is you feel small but connected to the world in that moment.
That, I mean, you just said it exactly the way I would have said it going down a rapid. Somehow you got inside my brain.
Well, and so the Keltner Lab and a number of other people have studied what happens when we experience awe, and they found, for instance, that you feel not just small and connected to the world, but you become more pro-social. You're more likely to look after other people. In other words, it's your ego diminishes. Right, you become more interested and enmeshed in the world around you. So we then carried on work thinking about awe and wonder, and we worked with Cirque du Soleil. And so we asked, you know, what is going inside your brain and what else might awe be doing to you? And what happens in terms of your brain is that your prefrontal cortex actually goes down. You actually become, your brain becomes more interconnected. You become more open. Okay. In addition, shortly after the experience of awe, what happens to your prefrontal cortex, again, at the front of your brain, its activity becomes what we call asymmetrical, becomes more active on one side than the other, in a way that's consistent with your desire to step forward into the world rather than step back. Because you could argue that any point in time, your brain is only ever making one decision. Everything else is a story. Do I step forward or do I step back? That's all, in a sense, we're ever doing. Right. And then we do stories, etc., for why we're doing one or the other. But in terms of behavior, other things happen. You become more tolerant to risk. In fact, you become more risk seeking. You become more willing to sit with uncertainty. You don't require so much cognitive closure. Right. You even change your perception of your past history in yourself. So when people experience awe, you ask, so are you someone who experienced awe a lot in the past? They're more likely to say yes. So they actually reframe their whole sense of self. And you become more open, right? You become more open to asking questions and willing to listen to understand someone. So we actually applied, we did a pilot study on looking to see whether we could use awe in art as a way of facilitating, as an initial step, to decreasing intolerance towards other people. And we found that depending on the context in which we presented awe, we could actually decrease intolerance. But we could also use it to increase intolerance because awe can be weaponized. So this is why military parades happen, right? Because you feel in awe, you feel small but connected to the people around you, and now you're open to suggestion. So this is why you have the cathedrals in church. Because, you know, the reason why you have a dome is it used to be a smaller dome, but it was for acoustic reasons for why there was a dome in the cathedrals. Because the choir was behind the altar and they couldn't be seen. And then they would sing and it would go up into the dome and then down to the congregation. So you have the sense of the sound coming from heaven. You're in awe. And now I'm going to give you a message about religion. Right. And you feel close to that congregation. So awe is super powerful.
Can people practice awe? I mean, like, cause, and also, can you define it just one more time? Because, like, when I'm thinking in my brain here about awe, I'm thinking, okay, curiosity, inspiration. It starts with questions about, I guess, what's possible. It's not quite like gratitude. It's kind of hard to define.
It's a great. So I would define it in terms of a brain state. It's a pattern of activity inside your head. That's what awe is, just like everything else. Or rather, in our body and in the pattern of activity into relationship, you know, between us and the world, etc. So I define it in that way. But perceptually, behaviorally, we would describe it as feeling that sense of, again, the diminishment of ego. You could argue that in some sense, it's our most powerful perception. And I think it inspires curiosity. I think it's the thing that comes before curiosity questions. It gives you the desire to step forward. A dear friend of mine called Dwayne Michaels, 87-year-old, wonderful, wonderful man. He's probably one of the world's most important living photographers. And when talking to him about this, he says, it's as if awe gives you the courage to overcome your cowardice. So when we work on trying to get behavioral change and perceptual change, and when we're working with children, for instance, my first step is to get them to care. Right. In some sense, I don't care what they care about in general. Of course, for any individual child to care a great deal about what they care about. But what I really want them, I'm not going to dictate what they care about. I just want them to care. Because if they don't care, they're not going to ask a question. Right. And if they're not going to ask a question, if they're not going to have that curiosity to ask a question, then they're never going to understand why. Right. We tend to ask safe questions like what and who and where. You know, these are data questions, useful but not meaningful. You know, asking why. And so people talk about asking why, which is very important. But there's something that comes before why, which is the desire to ask it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that you brought up sort of how you're teaching this to students, kids in particular, because I think a lot of this for adults is hard to grasp, right? And so how do you start with the most basic? Like, how could we teach this to someone who is young that needs to learn it? And so you're giving some good examples. What are some other examples of things that you're learning as ways to teach kids these principles?
Yeah, so we try to teach children these principles, but in fact, the strategy is no different from what we do with adults. It's the same process. In some sense, kids are already there. I think we actually have to unlearn adults towards children, if you see what I mean. There's a really interesting, you know, William James, famous, of course, psychologist, philosopher. He suggested that babies come into the world in this buzzing confusion, you know, blooming, buzzing confusion, right? And I can understand why he would say that, but I think it's probably wrong. Because if you're confused, it means you have an expectation of what was there. It's like, oh, this is not what I thought it was going to be. I'm now confused. But also confusion is not an impetus to step forward. It's an impetus to stand still or to step back. The last thing you want is a little critter coming into the world is recoil. You need them to explore because your brain only makes meaning by physically reaching out into the world and then getting feedback. So I think babies come into the world full of awe and wonder. It's like, that's amazing. That's amazing. I better go explore that. And then the leadership that you all work on and we work on is creating that environment that enables them to explore. It's not about protecting them from taking risks, it's to enable them to take it. And so children who are strongly attached to their parents feel secure. What's interesting is they're actually more likely to venture further from their parents, not stay near them. And the same's true. And
because they have that foundation, right?
They have that foundation. I call it the sandbar. And I think that's what love is. I think that's what leadership is. And I don't mean just leadership in an organization, leadership of within a relationship that's dialectic, but even leadership of yourself. So I say to my own children, I say, look, I'm not your boat. I'm not going to take you to the other side of the water. Why? Because you love swimming, right? But I'm going to be your sandbar. Okay, you're going to swim. You're going to get tired. I'm never going to let you drown. You're going to come back here. You can stand here. You're still in the water, right? You can still feel the beauty of the water, but you can rest. And now you can swim again. And over time, you're going to now have the strength to swim to the other side, right? And so while they were growing up, I would create situations where they were under risk. You know, maybe they at least they felt they were under risk, right? And because they needed to learn how to make those decisions and how to engage with that. But they knew that they weren't going to, they knew they had a sandbar. And then eventually they become their own sandbar.
Maybe it's just my own ego, but I feel suspicious often when I'm dealing with an institution that, like, they think they already know everything. It's like, it seems like to me that kills the awe sometimes. Yeah. And yeah.
Absolutely. And they do know everything, right? They're super efficient. The problem is they, and as a consequence, they don't ask good questions. Asking questions is great, but most questions are not good, right? It's a fascinating question, what defines a good question? And so what we work also with experts, and experts, what they are is really efficient. They're really good at being efficient, but they're not necessarily good at asking questions. So what we try to do is we combine experts with naive, not ignorant, but naive. And the idea is that people who are naive ask great questions, but they don't know they're great questions. But experts, though they can't ask a good question, can recognize a good question when asked. So it's a great combination. And we ourselves and our own selves can move between expert and naive within our own minds, because we can create an environment in which we step into it and we then become naive. Almost everything we do in the lab, I didn't know how to do it. Right. And so when we work with companies or individuals, we're in a sense the naive people. They're the experts.
Is that why you call yourselves the Lab of Misfits? Curious about that.
Yeah, the reason why it's the Lab of Misfits is because, well, we are. And in fact, I think everybody is. Everyone, I think, probably feels a misfit. And for us, for me, a misfit is not someone who doesn't fit. It's that they fit in many places. Right? They're not a single thing. None of us is a single thing. We have multiple personalities. We're contextual. I'm a different person on stage talking than I am off stage. I'm different with my children than I am with someone else, right? We are contextual. We're many things. What's more, when it comes to perception and perception, I mean, we're almost an infinite number of things, right? Because everything that you see, everything that you hear or feel is inside you, right? Music doesn't exist. It's inside your brain. If a tree falls in the woods and no one's there to hear it, does it make a sound? No, it creates energy, but the sound is a construct of your brain. You project it onto the world. But what's true for a tree is also true for other people. People are just the sources of meaningless information. And you generate a perception of them. You see the meaning of them, but that meaning is inside you, projected outward. So every personality you've ever perceived is actually inside you, projected outward, right? So we're contextual.
Is that why, you know, the flip side of this idea, you know, perception can lead you astray, but it can also, I've heard you talk about perception as being this incredible source of art and creativity and innovation and so many incredible positive things in the world, right?
Yeah. I think that everything, at least for humans, begins with perception. Behavioral change begins with perceptual change. One of the hardest things to do is not necessarily to change your behavior, it's to change the reason for the behavior, the meaning for the behavior, right? And so when you asked, when you were talking about awe, is there a way of experiencing awe? Is maybe awe a way of approaching the world? So a good friend of mine, and I'd say the answer is yes. So a good friend of mine, Larry Maloney, who's a professor at NYU, brilliant, brilliant individual, wonderful person. And he said to me, when his students walk into the room, he experiences awe every time. And I'm thinking, what? Why is that? And he says, think of it. It's trillions of molecules all moving together coherently and sitting in a chair. And I said, well, when you think of it that way, absolutely, that is amazing. Right. So in other words, that was his choice as to how to see his students. I mean, he's a deeply empathic person. So it's not like he's seeing them as molecules, but he's seeing what I call seeing the impossible in the common. And I think that's where we can find awe, by perceiving what seems miraculous in every day. So we can explore that. And we've created an awe journal for people to try to find the impossible in the common. And because you don't have to be an astronaut to go up to space to look back and see the whole Earth and think, that's amazing. And as inspiring as that story is, it means I need a spaceship in order to transform. But why can't we have that experience every moment by choosing how to see things, not what to see, but how to see, how to experience, how to perceive, how to hear.
Wow.
Well, Bo, I'd love to finish coming back to kind of this present moment in our lives. Most of us still at home and trying to make sense out of everything that's happening and dealing with various levels of uncertainty. For those listeners who are still kind of caught up in the moment of all this uncertainty and how to manage it, what's some real practical advice for how to get started on a path towards making progress with getting comfortable with the uncertainty?
It's a great question. I'm not sure the solution, by the way, is to be comfortable with uncertainty necessarily, right? I'm not sure we can ever be comfortable in constant uncertainty. We need sandbars. We need certainty from which to step into uncertainty. So first, it's to try to find those certainties that enable you to step into uncertainty, right? But the first one is, again, to understand that what you're experiencing is natural. It's normal. It's okay. But you can also have agency over it. You can become proactive rather than reactive. And we can become proactive in things that actually, for instance, physical health. So some practical solutions, not solutions, but practical ways of experiencing is that you see people, especially at the beginning, rushing to the grocery store to fill their physical pantries, mainly with toilet paper, right? What was that about, right? And that was about trying to find certainty. That was about trying to exhibit some element of an empowered brain, which means I have control over my fate. And so that's unconsciously what people are trying to do, getting a sense of control in a situation for which there was little. Because what we're experiencing for many people, for the very first time, for biologists and for yourself, and Eric, you talk about how in your leadership, it's not about you, it's about the team, it's about the interaction that your behavior affects others and they affect you. And for many people, especially in the West, especially in the States, who think that they're islands, that they are self-made, that they're independent, these are illusions. No one is self-made. No one is independent. Everybody is necessarily affecting other people. That is always how it's been. Whenever you went into a cafe, you breathe the air, you were always breathing the air of that has already gone through 20 sets of lungs. Every time you touched a handle, you were holding the hands of 30 people. It has always been this way, right? We are fundamentally interconnected. It can't be different. That is biology. That is life. And that realization can be very scary for people because it means that their life doesn't just belong to them. It means that they are not in complete control of their fate. It means someone else can affect them. Now we have something else that they can't even see that can have an effect on their body that they have no control over. Well, actually, for every one cell that's inside us, there are nine cells inside us that don't belong to us. 90% of our cells inside our body aren't even ours. They're bacterium that are living symbiotically with us in mutualism. So you don't have to look outside yourself to find how we are fundamentally interdependent, right? But that's a beautiful thing. There's empowerment in that. Unfortunately, people feel disempowered. And so understanding this will help people, I think, in seeing the reality of what's always been there. That this, not the situation, of course, is new, but the interdependence is not new. And then it's about being proactive. So when people are panicking, going out and filling their pantries, my suggestion is, because they're getting prepared, prepare your body. The probability in time of getting the infection is probably relatively high for everybody, given enough time, right? So a body that is physically prepared for that is more likely to do better. So prepare your physical self. Get your exercise your respiratory system, exercise your heart. Go out walking, go out exercising, being proactive in that sense will also decrease your cortisol because it will give you a sense that you're being proactive in the world, that you have some element of control. and you'll decrease the amount of stress that you're feeling. You can apply that strategy to many things. In the way you talk to someone, in choosing not to get angry with your partner, in choosing try to understand your partner rather than just be reactive and control. So activate, basically it's activate your prefrontal is the message.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Bo, tell our listeners where they can go to learn more about your work.
So they can go to a number of places. The main destination is the labofmisfits.com. And we have, we created a new section on the site, which is called Community. And in that, we are now creating a series of not just blogs, but content on thriving in uncertainty. And then we have Instagram and the other usual channels.
And you have three, I think, incredible TED Talks, where one of them you bring in Cirque du Soleil, and it's so A+. Everyone has to check those out as well.
Oh, thank you. We also have a book called Deviate, which is all about deviating in uncertainty, right? How to adapt to uncertainty.
And as always, listeners, you can go to our show notes at nobearerspodcast.com to access all the things that Bo just mentioned to find out more and learn more. Bo, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you and learn from you. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. It's always great to see you, Eric, and see you as well.
Awesome.
Wonderful.
Well, Eric, what did you hear from today's conversation that stood out for you?
Well, the crazy part is that speaking to Dr. Bolotto, I'm full of awe right now. I'm really like I'm lifted. I feel like there's sort of a positive glow, and I want to get out there and be better and learn more. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of really wild that the effect me for me personally of this conversation is to create the very thing that Bo was talking about. I think secondly, for me, so many of the pioneers, the thought leaders that we've interviewed have started with awareness. And man, I learned this when I was kayaking, and you know, you're on the surface of the river and you're experiencing all this energy getting knocked around, but really the energy is coming from the very bottom of the river. It's like the currents hitting rocks and going over drops, and it's so far down there. And I mean, essentially, I mean, in my way, that's what Bo has been studying, how to dive into the brain and understand what's going on inside of us. And again, a big part of it is not going through the world, quote unquote, blind, but actually diving in and being aware of your perception of the world and yourself, and the way that you your senses work. And all of that is just so, for me, illuminating. I use that word in the beginning of the podcast, and I'll use it at the end because it begins with awareness. I mean, Dave, that's what we're doing, right? With our No Barriers Life Elements, right? People go, what's the solution? I'm like, there's no solution. It's just being aware of this process that we all go through that connects us all.
Yeah, so true. Yeah. And for me, I felt as a father, I loved his advice about how to talk to your kids and how to help them think about these things. But as someone who wrestles with these moments in our programs where kids or vets or whoever we're serving is really struggling or even lashing out or having, you know, behaviors that you don't expect, that whole conversation about what those folks are really doing is they're trying to hold on to their identity. They're struggling to figure out who they are in this new world, and that it's perfectly natural for them to have these eruptive behaviors because they don't know what to do with the lack of identity that they're struggling to find. I think that that's a really important lesson for the people that we serve. And even as our staff think about how to serve people better, to recognize that that is what that behavior is trying to do. It's trying to grasp onto an identity that they know. Well, again, listeners, nobearerspodcast.com is where you can find today's show notes. If you are interested in joining No Barriers for our upcoming No Barriers Summit, we've had to move that virtual, but we're pretty excited about the experience we've created. You can learn more at nobarrierssummit.org and join us live June 26th, 27th. If you can't make it those dates, we'll have virtual recordings of everything and ways for you to access it, but it's going to be an extraordinary celebration of the power of the human spirit to transcend what we're facing right now in our lives. So thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
No barriers.
The production team behind this podcast includes senior producer Pauline Schaefer, executive producer Diedrich Jonk, sound design, editing, and mixing by Tyler Kottman, graphics by Sam Davis, and marketing support by Megan Lee and Carly Sandsmark. Special thanks to the Dan Ryan Band for our intro song, Guidance. And thanks to all of you for listening. We know that you've got a lot of choices about how you can spend your time, and we appreciate you spending it with us. If you enjoy this podcast, we encourage you to subscribe to it, share it, and give us a review. Show notes can be found at nobarrierspodcast.com.